This is Paul McGann.
The Eighth Doctor, you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus.
I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
I'm Lauren from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, where you've got a friend in me. You got a friend in me when the timeline looks rough ahead, and you've got silence and Daleks running through your head. Just remember what your doctor said. You've got a friend. I'm Kier.
And I'm Jay, and this week we're revisiting another panel from Regeneration Who. In a conversation we titled The Doctor-Companion Symbiosis, we took a look at the mutually beneficial relationship between a Time Lord and the Traveling Associates from both the classic and modern eras, as well as doing a little hypothesizing on the upcoming new companions for Series 11.
Yeah, it was actually a really engaging conversation. Haley and I were fortunate enough to sit down with Joy Piedmont of Reality Bomb, one of our past guests from GPR for a couple of episodes, Heather McHale, who you also heard on the last panel that we shared from Regen 4. And we actually sat down also with Doctor Who writer Nev Fountain, who you'll recognize from a lot of Big Finish audios, as well as some of our published material, and really sort of dug into this one. I'm really kind of glad that we had this particular discussion heading into Series 11 and what it really means to have these companions, but they're not really companions. They might just be recurring characters or however you want to describe them. So here's where we dug into it. Enjoy.
My name is Kier Hansen. I'm the host of a Whovian podcast called Gallifrey Public Radio. I'm joined by one of my co-hosts. She'll introduce herself momentarily. But this panel is being referred to as Doctor Companion Symbiosis. It's actually a panel topic that we tend to bring around every once in a while at cons over the course of the years, because every time we start to broach a new series, the idea about what is our next Doctor or next Companion is really going to bring to the character and archetype dynamic. So we wanted to talk about specifically that symbiotic relationship, the gains on both sides of the relationship that both characters, hopefully, if deftly handled, will be able to experience over the course of their interaction, from both classic and modern eras. And we're going to use some of the closing time to talk about some, not necessarily hopes and wishes for what we will see in Series 11, but what maybe, as far as the product of the program, would be best served presenting to an audience for a number of reasons. So we've got a pretty distinguished panel with some varied backgrounds. I'll give them an opportunity to introduce themselves, starting with Joy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joy Piedmont. I am a co-producer of Reality Bomb, a Doctor Who podcast. And my day job is I'm a teacher and a librarian and Doctor Who fan. Doctor Who fan, so.
Hi, I'm Nev Fountain. I've been a professional writer for 20 years. I write lots and lots of Big Finishes, and I write a lot of comedy, including Dead Ringers, which has a Doctor Who component in it for Radio 4, and I do that and books and things like that and magazines. That's me.
Excellent. Haley.
Hello, my name is Haley Malley. I am Kier's co-host on Gallifrey Public Radio. I do several other podcasts as well. And I am an engineer in my day job.
Science. Math with explosions.
She drives trains.
Heather.
I'm Heather McHale. I'm a teacher at the University of Maryland. I'm currently working on a book. I say that as though it hasn't been true for like 4 years, about the companions in Doctor Who. And I'm the managing editor of the Journal of Science Fiction, which is a scholarly journal. And if you are at all a scholarly writer, you should hit me up because we really need more people. So.
Nice plug. Well done. Well, I figured obviously one of the starting points on any of these things is to talk about the original intent of the character and whether or not we really believe that from its inception that the companion was intended to be the touchstone for the viewer. Whether they were there to provide a rationale for the exposition, something for the viewer to sort of treat as what I often refer to as the Watson. We'll get into some of those relationships momentarily. But down the table here, if anyone wants to jump in and either confirm or challenge the fact that as we saw our original set of companions, Ian, Barbara, even Susan to a certain extent, whether they were there to basically push the format of the program and the intent that maybe was expected.
Well, I could be wrong, but I think that with Barbara and Ian as teachers, and you know, one is a history teacher and one is a science teacher, they were supposed to be conduits for the information, and so they were there to serve a narrative purpose, but it was a little different in terms of their relationship to the Doctor was not necessarily what they were serving. It was more like just the content, so that they could have people with some sort of authority on the subject be able to speak on it. So I think that's kind of where they started, at least, but I'm not totally sure on that.
Well, so you got them as the science and history experts, and then you've got Susan with knowledge of the future. But they're all just really educated students for the Doctor to be the expert. So they can ask an educated question so you can get an educated answer.
Okay, yeah, so the tee-up for the exposition the Doctor will eventually provide. If we're looking at this as some sort of a symbiotic relationship, then what does the Doctor himself, in this iteration, we're talking about Harkness here, what does he gain from having those counterpoints?
Well, I see it... Well, when it started, I think it evolved mainly from a lot of the classic genre literature, which was British, UK literature. So, and what you have in books like The Lost World and The First Men on the Moon is an ensemble of characters to each provide various points of view. So the Doctor wasn't the main character, even though it was his name. He was one of a set of characters. He was the Captain Nemo. He was the caver, the facilitator to the next world, and Ian and Barbara's points of view were as important as the Doctor, especially in those early stories such as the Daleks and An Earthly Child. And Susan's character sort of withered away, but it was very much their show, and it comes from that idea that, you know, you put a series of characters with different perspectives all together in peril, and it goes from story to story. I don't think it's any coincidence that the first story after they leave, we encounter the first person from the Doctor's race. When the story starts to become about the Doctor and stops becoming about Ian and Barbara and the Doctor and a girl companion. So I think it's a very equal team in that sense. It becomes more about the Doctor only when that initial team break up completely.
And you only have one constant factor.
Yeah, I think by default, William Hartnell's Doctor becomes the main character in a sense, even though it's called Doctor Who, because he's the longest-serving actor in that cast. And it becomes more and more about him fighting enemies because the characters around him are playing catch-up because they're new characters and they're young characters and they're orphans. And by nature of that, if Ian and Barbara had stayed and become as savvy as William as the first Doctor, then the dynamic would be completely different to what it was with Stephen and Vicky and Ben and Polly. The dynamic changes because the actors who chose to leave first were the school teachers and of course Susan.
Which marks a tipping point as far as the nature of that character relationship. So we start heading more into the dramatic and less the scientific and historical exposition aspect of it. So now we're starting to deal more with character development rather than story development. It becomes more character driven, or at least has the opportunity to become more character driven, I would imagine.
Well, I think the characters are very well defined, but it is a question of how do we get out of this situation rather than how do we fight the baddies. Terry Nation's writing was very much atypical. We had the Aztecs, and basically it's how do we get out of this, the Aztec world, and how do we get out of the revolution, and how do we get out of this? It's a question of, like Sliders. It was just like, how do we get out of this peril? And it like The Lost World and other classic books, is we're in a peril, and we just have to get out of it. We don't have to fight any particular monsters or villains. How do we get out of it?
So I guess we can kind of look at, as far as some of the reference material for these, for the variations on these relationships that we've had historically, and they don't follow any sort of chronological order, because I think writers and script editors, producers have had an opportunity to tinker with combinations or jumping back and forth between some of these symbiotic pairings or multiplicities at times. I referred to the Watson before. The Sherlock and Watson is kind of a dynamic that we've seen utilized quite a bit. That's the person always asking the questions over the shoulder of the from the inferior mind. You know, what exactly are you doing? That's teeing up the explanation for the greater exposition. Obviously, I would think to a certain degree, Barbara held that role in its inception because she had the really quizzical, analytical persona and wanted to get the explanation. And again, it was really there for the audience benefit. But we even saw it going forward with Dodo and Joe Grant and Amy and Bill, really. But we're going to start to get into some of the areas where those relationships blur. Were there ever any other instances of ones that were just the boiled down prototypical Sherlock Watson relationships as far as doctor and companion that really stand out?
Well, can I just nudge your description of the Watson
just
for a second? But something that Conan Doyle knew and that good writers tend to know is that the only really useful and interesting Watsons are smart. It's a real mistake to write something where you have it kind of a stupid Watson. And it's tempting, people do it sometimes, but when you do that, then it's not interesting, because then, you know, why would the doctor or Sherlock Holmes or whoever invest that much in somebody who isn't even, like, smart for a person, right? So one of the things that's really interesting about a well-written Watson character is that they have to be really smart for a human, but think like a human. That human element is so important, because that's what makes them different from the doctor or Sherlock Holmes, who has, you know, let's face it, almost no social skills. So, you know, to me, Barbara's a very good example. I actually think Barbara and Ian together do that very well, because Ian is also very, you know, investigatory and wanting to know everything. But they both have the intelligence and the curiosity paired with the sort of essential human dimension, that they care about people, you know, they invest in the people they meet. And so, I mean, to me, you know, they're a good example. Ace is a good example. You know, of somebody who, you know, wherever they go, she's sort of doing this relationship building stuff and intellectual work. I think there are lots of those characters in Doctor Who, but Ace is maybe the one that jumps to mind immediately for me, because she's so good at seeing things totally differently from the way the Doctor does, but in a way that's complementary to him.
Well, in that description, it's making me specifically think of the time when Amy kind of saw things from a perspective that the Doctor wouldn't, like in The Beast Below, where she saw an element of what was going on in the society that the Doctor couldn't see. Like, the companion kind of fills in the blind spots that the Doctor has.
Absolutely.
Because he's not a human, and he doesn't understand what it is to be a human.
Okay. Subtle variations, though, where we're working against something like the teacher-student relationship, where you may not have anywhere close to the equal as far as intellect, but it's just a constant state of query. I don't understand. Do you feel, though, in that sort of a relationship, where I'm thinking specifically the Ben and Polly, fell into that category pretty well, Leela, obviously, in some of the early stages, Mel as well, you might even argue, Ace in the early stages, Nyssa in the early stages, Adric, you know, for all of his mathematical prowess, was socially inept. And again, Bill, literally the teacher-pupil relationship, professor-pupil. But then where is the other side of that symbiosis?
Are you asking what the companion gives the doctor?
Yeah, what is the gain for the educator in that sort of a relationship, as far as somebody who is constantly in a state of questioning or looking for, not necessarily challenging, strictly querying?
Well, if you want to understand something better, you should teach it. I mean, that's, anybody who's a teacher knows that. And there are lots of moments where you see the doctor putting something together because he's been asked. You know, I don't necessarily, there are lots of other things that the companion brings to the table, but you know, the function of that questioning is not just to say to the viewer, the doctor needs a reason to say this out loud, you know, but a lot of the time also, like, the doctor needs a reason to ask himself that question, a reason to articulate that answer. So I think that's part of it.
Okay.
I might also say that there's like a practicality, like also in terms of the symbiosis, like not just the what the character gains, you know, in terms of emotional growth or something like that, but like even when you just look at the relationship with Leela, like Leela did all the dirty work for the doctor. And so I think that actually you see over the course of that relationship, he grows to respect her skills in a way that he might not have when he first meets her, because he keeps trying to, you know, civilize her and make her different. But over time, you see he's actually starting to appreciate the things that she knows and, you know, her ability to go in and fight when he's like, oh, I can't do this.
Well, it's also very easy for the doctor, because of who he is and how his life is lived, to become jaded. And the wonder and curiosity of a new young companion who is his student kind of helps temper that aspect of his personality.
I was going to say, as somebody who teaches myself, I mean, I teach other people, but you know what I mean, that I do. The joy of sharing, the joy of watching that light bulb go on in somebody's head when they've gained some small measure of enlightenment that you passed on to them. There's nothing, it's the rush of teaching.
Well, it's the resolution of the Socratic method. Lead the student to the conclusion.
I mean, right.
That's absolutely true. Now, as far as some of the character intricacies and interplay that you've played with within the Big Finish audio, you're behind a bit of an extra challenge because of the fact that you have to have some forced exposition in doing it strictly through an audio format. Mm. So you've got to do a lot of, obviously, you know, scene description and things of that sort, and obviously description of action and those things. But as far as the character interaction, how do you decide between, all right, this exchange is really done just to sort of move the information forward, versus this is something where the character is actually actively seeking some growth through their questioning and looking to try to find reasoning. Is that a conscious effort?
No, I think the role of the companion in Doctor Who is ever to just to split the story and to create more perspectives on the story, because if you just had the Doctor's perspective on the story, it'd be a vain, strangely dry and odd perspective. I mean, I did the Kingmaker about the princes in the tower, and because the Doctor was treating it like a kind of like a murder mystery weekend, and he comes up against his responsibilities. But on the other hand, you had Perry and Eremin with both completely different perspectives on the mystery of the princes in the tower. Perry wanting to save the princes, Eremem saying we should just leave history alone because of her perspective as an Egyptian queen, and not seeing life being that sacred and just allowing people to die to do the web of time. So the best thing that a companion can do is to provide different perspectives, not exposition, because in some senses we're all so savvy in the way the Doctor Who works as a story, and a lot of the companions in Big Finish, simply by the fact that loads and loads of stories have been produced with Perry, with Ace, they are as savvy as the Doctor now because they've had all these stories. Mm-hmm. So it's perspective on the moral situation, the story. I've just been writing a Perry Sixth Doctor at the moment, and I'm writing the Perry as being as up to speed on things, just like Clara and the Twelfth Doctor. They both actually have a language and they both know what's going on, but their moral sense of what's happening, like as I go back to the sixth doctrine, the 12th doctrine, Clara, like in Kill the Moon, the moral difference is the important thing, rather than who knows more about the situation than the other person. That's not as important anymore. I think as an audience, we don't want to be spoon-fed exactly what's going on, because we can see what's going on. We know science fiction, we know the things. And in some senses, that's right. Like, if we saw someone like Susan, like this technological product of a technologically advanced society, being as naive about the situation that she's in the 60s, now we just go, why is she acting like that? She's from the Doctor civilization. She should be giving all the techno babble. She should be talking about planets. But we just accept the fact that Susan is a naive person. But equally, we can see people from the 20th, 21st century talking with the Doctor about planets and stuff they visited, like it's just like a holiday, like Rose and the 9th and the 10th. So that's a rather long-winded way of saying, I don't think it's about sharing of information, I think it's about difference of perspective. And that's what the Companion's about now.
Also, that actually leads us well in terms of something that's been explored more recently, or I would say more so within the newer iteration of the program as opposed to our classic or legend editions, has to be a reversal of the teacher student, sort of the, you know, Doctor, you really could learn something from me on this. And I think we get a chance to explore that more often now as we're dealing with characters like River or a Shilder. Well, by the time she gets to me, and we start getting to May or me, and having, you know, the millennia of experience, and Missing, obviously, as that sort of an intellectual equal. So now we're dealing with the Doctor, the tables being turned, and the Doctor actually gaining from the student, because the student is in a better position. Sometimes it's from a moral or empathetic enlightenment, but there may also be instances where the Doctor's data set is just incomplete, and the Companion in that instance is there to be able to fill some of the gaps. So I'm wondering if that may be some sort of a newer evolution of the program, where we now, as a result of 54 years of seeing these sort of interactions and all the permutations of the way the Doctor has contributed to the situation, what if we turn the table 45 degrees and now say there are some areas where the Doctor needs to build on their information source?
Well, I think it's a course correction in terms of any long-running series, because it has to adjust, because the longer a series goes on, the reality of the series outside of it is more heavily on its shoulders. I mean, I use a Columbo example. The first Columbo episode, he's seen as a kind of like an underdog, and he's not very impressive. But if that carries on and you have to solve 40 cases, you can't do that anymore. He has to have some element of respect. And after 54 years, we see the Doctor as this omnipotent being who everyone thinks is fantastic, and he solves, you know, basically Daleks and Cybermen just run away from him. So what is the role of the Companion if the Doctor is that powerful, is that infallible? If he's become this Mary Sue and everyone thinks he's wonderful and he can just shout at them and they can just go away. Is it the moral perspective is the only thing left? And making the 12th Doctor more alien and less savvy about human language and human behaviour and just how you see people. You're a very beautiful woman, probably, that kind of meme. That's the only way to go, really. You've got to give the Earth person that perspective, and perspective comes more and more important when you don't even have, the Doctor doesn't even have to explain what's going on, because the shortcuts are so there.
In early stories, this is why they would split them up in teams, because these two, Barbara and Ian, for example, would gain information that the Doctor needed to complete the puzzle, and when they eventually came back up together, they could communicate that information together. You don't see as much of that these days, but now that we have a larger TARDIS team coming in, maybe we'll see more of that.
We're definitely going to get to that. That's actually going to be our button on this. So one of the things that we've also seen worked in varying degrees or varying depths of the relationship, if you want to look at it as so, are the friends and partners.
you know, where now they are sort of there's an equal footing as far as the respect and mutual protection of one another. You know, the I'm here for you when you need me sort of relationship that works bidirectionally. I think we really saw emerge as early as Jamie was probably the instance, I think, in my mind that really stands out as one of the first true friends of the Doctor, because you know, Hartnell's Doctor wanted to maintain a certain degree of separation from them for their own safety and benefit, I believe. But then we see, you know, obviously, going through Romana, Grace Holloway. I'm going to put her in there because, damn it, if I don't include the 96 film in this thing. So Grace Holloway is definitely the friend and partner kind of a relationship. But there's a... When you're looking at those, as far as the friend companions of the Doctor, where it moves forward into going to the next level and being the family member, okay, that one more layer. And obviously you can't, Susan being, you know, written into it, but we really explored the living hell out of that with the Ponsons. I'm trying to think if there were, but that's a long gap in between. Can we think of other instances where you think that friendship that moved to the degree of family closeness was there between those bookends?
I mean, I feel like it's not that much sooner, but I feel like Donna is a really good example of the Doctor being really good friends with his companion, to the point where the constant joke was like, oh, we're not together. We are just friends. Like, this is just a friendship.
That was very much a sibling relationship. Yeah, I was going to say, somebody overheard a conversation I was having with my brother one time, and they were like, wow, you sound terrible when you talk to him. It's like, how do you talk to your brother? That's how you talk to your brother.
Sarah Jane, obviously, you said there was a big gap there. I would like to think that Perry... there's really, I mean, you've got to go back and look at those episodes. The Doctor treats her mostly terribly. Yeah. And you really have to be an incredibly, at least on her side, I think she gave a lot more than she got in that relationship. But she certainly was a friend to him. He wasn't always a friend to her.
Do you think it reached the sort of the sibling...
Oh, yeah, by the end of it. Yeah.
Well, I would say more so, especially with what got explored with The Big Finish. I think both characters, both Old Sixie and Perry, opened up exponentially in the audio to a degree that I almost, that it almost hurts. As much as I love the Six Doctors televised era, I think to myself, God, there's so much potential there that didn't get an opportunity to be witnessed, because obviously with adept writers at hand being able to... I thought it was a good point too. Hooray, thank you, Ned, for writing good stories with it. And to a certain degree, I think it actually benefited, and I'm going to go off on a little bit of a Big Finish tangent here, but bringing in Aramim as that third wheel. But because of the fact that then brings somebody else who gets to see the two of them after their years and their experiences, saying, okay, you two have a relationship that's quite unusual because of the fact that you're such dramatically different people and such a personality clash, and yet your clash of personalities is that what actually gets the two of you to work better together? Like, you've got a giant hole, but you've got the other piece of the puzzle, the two of you actually mesh nicely and seamlessly. And she comes in and just puts a nice gloss over the whole thing because of her energy level, and obviously her horrible backstory. I mean, horrific backstory, not horrible. Horrific backstory. They're two totally different answers. Then you have to move one step beyond. Now you're into the lovers. We've gone, instead of friends that become as close as family, now I want to snog you.
So you start with Barbara.
Clearly. But what do we do about...
He agrees.
Is there still a place right now, I guess? And I'm not actually referring to Series 11, but I'm just referring to 2018, the program where it currently stands, where you think that we could, where there would even be the patience for bringing a romantic interest back in for our titular character.
I think you really can't do that with your first female doctor.
Yeah.
especially not in the first season. You can't end the very first season with your first female doctor and then start with a love interest.
You know, I mean, and even beyond that, I would argue that right now the cultural climate is very concerned about consent. And I don't think you could do that with a human companion. I think it would, I can't imagine any way of writing that so that your 2,000-year-old doctor could have a human-scale romantic companion and it wouldn't be creepy and exploitative. I just don't know how you would write that.
Well, the reason River worked is because she was part-time.
Right.
Lord. You know, she had a time head.
Right, and I think that makes a big difference. I really do. I mean, I don't see any good way of... Well, I mean, partly I'm just predisposed against it. I don't like it. You know, I like the doctor to be something other than that, you know. But I think it's a real problem, you know, to think that you could expect your human character to understand the gulf between them well enough to accept that gulf in a way that is meaningful. So I'm opposed. And, you know, they never consult me, so, you know.
They never return anyway email.
I know.
We're sure they're listening to all the podcasts, so they know what we're saying.
They know, right?
I think, I don't think it will happen again, because I don't think, especially not with a companion, accepted. I think Stephen and Chris saw there was a great validity in the closeness of Rose and the Doctor, but there were a lot of elephant traps in the drama, and I think any sensible showrunner will go, yes, but this kind of thing just turns in on itself and you end up looking like a rather selfish pair when you're meant to be an outgoing pair dealing with the dangers of the universe. Now, what works so well in series one with Chris and Billy, the characters, not the actors, but the characters, didn't seem to work as well in season two. It just came rather incestuous, and the Doctor's own humanity, by way of contradiction, was distorted. I mean, with Love of Monsters? The Doctor is more concerned about Rose's mother than he is about, like, people being absorbed and destroyed, and more concerned about making jokes than seeing other people being destroyed by a werewolf. It's just, when you focus too much on the person next to you, and you can get up to that point with friends. I mean, the Doctor and Sarah were very, you know, they were very much a unit, and Perry and the Doctor did actually go at each other handed. But there is a line, you know, when you're in a situation of peril, it's a family thriller or a children's thriller, whatever you want to call it, and basically things are dreadful that are happening all the time, and how do you have time for some kind of relationship in the middle of it without looking quite unpleasant in places? When you're obsessed about saving a person who you love so much that you're actually ignoring, I mean, I'm sorry about that, the Christopher Eccleston line, you know, I'll save the Earth but lose you in World War III. And I love World War III and Aliens of London, but I just find that line just so awful and tacked on, because I like to put it as kind of like shell shock from the Time War and just fastening on to Rose like a duckling, like a beret, you know, just on anything. Because any sensible, clear-thinking doctor would know there is a higher morality and lots to do. And sometimes you'll have to sacrifice a companion in some senses, because there are worlds at stake and populations at stake. I just think for all those reasons, I don't think Chris would get back into that.
Yeah, I think that the Rose and the Doctor specifically worked very well in the first season of the relaunch of Doctor Who, because so many people didn't know who or what the Doctor really was and what it meant for him to be who he was. I think if you tried to introduce a very similar storyline now, it doesn't play as well, because we already know, like, how important it is about the things the Doctor does, the sacrifices he's willing to make to save the world or the universe or, you know, whatever he's trying to save. And we didn't, like, I personally started with Rose as a new Whovian. And so, like, of course he's going to sacrifice the universe to save his companion. Why wouldn't he? I didn't know better at the time, but rewatching that now, it doesn't hold up as well.
Well, I'd like to put in another element on the other side. Both started by Russell, both actually very sensible, but both things that can't last. One is the affection for the companion, and the other is the Doctor's own destruction of his home world. Both of which are great dramatic things, but both of which can't sustain, because you can't actually have the Doctor get over committing genocide of his own people. Because the further down the line he was, Stephen was going, this is not a situation that I can continue. But the man who regrets, the man who forgets, you can't have Matt Smith leaping around, because he's still the man who's committed genocide and killed children and old people and all manner of people on his own home planet. So you have to fix that. Mm-hmm. And the other side is the romantic entanglement with companions, and you kind of move on from that. Mm. But both are great, sound, dramatic devices, but both can't be sustained. Mm-hmm. Not on a show that's going to last for 50-odd years.
Mm. Yeah. I think that the show has kind of gone out of its way in recent years, and I guess that's due to Moffat, to say very clearly, you know, through Missy, saying, you're a pet, essentially. You know, to say to Clara, like, you're cute, and the Doctor enjoys having you around, but you are not on the same level as us. Like, I can be friends with him, you cannot. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know that I believe that as an audience, you know, watching the show. I think that that's kind of like a cruel way of putting things. But I think there is some truth to there being a fundamental difference in the two relationships.
There is also, and I've been writing about this in The Big Finish, which I'm currently doing, I'm just finished, about sense of responsibility for the companions. And in the William Hartnell time, it was very well constructed and very well done. He had a relative that he felt responsible for, who was in the same situation as him, and he had two school teachers who barged their way, and the show was very well constructed, and it took all the responsibility off the Doctor's shoulders. They barged onto his ship. He can't get them home because it's the TARDIS's fault. None of this is his fault, essentially. Mm-hmm. A little bit is, but most of it isn't. And one by one, when Ian and Barbara go, they are replaced by orphans, by people stranded on planets, by people that the Doctor takes away because they're in a terrible situation themselves. Katerina and Vicky and Stephen. And it is interesting enough, the first time a companion voluntarily walks into the TARDIS was a bodge job and a quick rewrite, which was Dodo. Mm. And it's from that point on that pattern of orphans, people running from great danger, the Doctor's responsibility for them isn't apparent. And we have moved slowly from people volunteering to go onto the TARDIS, and like Perry, and people assigned to the TARDIS. I mean, ever since the new series has started, there's people just freely going onto the TARDIS, leaving the TARDIS, going, and the Doctor is very responsible for them in that sense. And the romantic entanglement puts something on top of that as well. Mm. And that is something that the series can never resolve properly, because it is mutated from that idea that these people travelling with the Doctor, yes, they're in a lot of danger, but they were in a pretty shitty situation when they started, so that's fine. Like Jamie and people like that. Mm. But now you have people like Joe and Sarah freely joining the TARDIS, and they've got families and people and a good home, and the Doctor's responsibility for them is absolute. He's taken them away and they might die. It's why Perry is so much more shocking than Adric, because Adric was an orphan who stowed away, and people don't feel, well, that's the thing you chose. Well, you know, you did that, okay, that's fine, your responsibility. Perry went for a holiday. It feels much more shocking and profound because you feel the Doctor is more responsible. Okay. You feel that.
As far as the Doctor's gain on that, so as far as the sense of responsibility and the impetus that puts on a lot of the decisions that they end up making, whether the situation be something that is putting them personally in peril, or whether you come into the dynamic of the good of the many versus the one, a lot of these things we have to make the moral decisions on, the Sophie's choice of sci-fi viewers. There's also the instances where we're dealing with companions who their their relationship with the doctor or the symbiosis there is the action of impulse versus the voice of conscience. The instances where we've run into iterations or moments within the doctor's progress where their empathy and their sympathy has dampened because of circumstances or because of recent experiences, and now you need a character who's going to step in and say, I need you to think twice about this because you've got some blinders on at the moment, whether they be emotional blinders or what have you. And that's where I'm falling into the rose to a certain degree. Obviously, was the one where, you know, we need to. You're dealing with humans here. I need to teach you. I need to remind you every once in a while to think humanly. Amy as well, but in a sort of an alien sense, River was the conscience from time to time because the doctor would forget themselves.
He had to be told that, hey, you can't travel alone. You forget what humanity is. Mm. But when you go off by yourself for too long,
right.
You lose that.
That was, Dark Doctor.
That was Donna, the end of Runaway Bride, right? Yeah. Don't travel on your own.
Yeah.
A lot of the new series and the old series, what is subtext becomes text. You know, you say it out loud. A lot of the things that are actually under the surface, and the doctor
right.
Traveling on his own is a very odd, would be a very odd thing. And yeah, they're saying it, you know, Donna is saying it out loud. Do you not
I
travel on
Amy
your own?
I think Amy had to tell him again,
did
too.
Did you? Don't travel on your own, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's something that the show has always had built in. And it's, you know, Ian and Barbara are very explicitly the doctor's moral teachers. It's, you know, from the beginning. And part of it is, like, you know, the doctor's different, right, from the hero that he grows into. So there's a lot of room for them to do that. But, you know, you get some really explicit things like, you know, Barbara saying, you know, you consider everybody else less important than you are, right? And those kinds of moments, I think that's actually one of the really consistent through lines of the companion role, that almost every single companion we've ever had has done that. And the reason for that is that it is a logical thing for the companion to be able to do that the doctor needs. And, you know, he's supposed to be brilliant. He's supposed to be, you know, incredibly clever and advanced and all these things. So that there aren't a huge number of concrete things that your companion is bringing to the table. And that's why I think that is so consistently one of the things that the companion can do and does do. I mean, I can only think of a handful of companions who I don't think engage in that, and they're the ones that I don't think work.
Well, basically, talking about that, she apparently was seen to be the only companion who actively worked at getting herself back on the TARDIS after she left the first time. I mean, she had suitcases in her car just in case she ran across him. And she basically served very well as his conscience when you get to the fires of Pompeii.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very rare that a companion can actually change a doctor's mind when he starts going on about the sanctity of time and you can't change it or whatever. She does it. She guilts him basically into going back and saving the family.
Very few other companions you can think of who would grab the doctor by the lapels and shake them until their decision is changed.
Yes. Yeah. Sarah was another one who did it a couple of times, basically. She called him out on his
alienism. Speaking from a point of familiarity, because she knew better and knew them better.
I think it's a very good point. It's particularly beholden to the companions who are around when the doctor changes, because we think of the doctor as a constant character, but basically he does become a new character and has to relearn. It's like I said, the show is like the broom that's had the handle replaced 20 times and the head replaced 19 times. It becomes a new show, and the doctor relearns. And sometimes the companion, such as Sarah in Robot and Perry in The Twin Dilemma, to tell the doctor what he should know, because he starts as a new character, and the process of learning goes backwards and forwards, particularly when he changes.
Which is going to tee us up really well in just a moment for the series 11 discussion, because this is a one where we haven't seen it in quite a while. Since 11th hour, where we're dealing with the topic of Rasa, so we get to that momentarily. You had something to add to this?
No, I was going to say, like, one of my favorite episodes, Turn Left, is the perfect example of just how important the companion relationship is to the doctor, and like that one little moment, like he was ready to go, just burn it all down, mm-hmm. and that would have destroyed everything, but just having someone there to be that moral compass, like, okay, you're going a little too far. Like, even they've barely known each other at that point, mm-hmm. but just having someone there can change everything.
Peace below is another good example.
Absolutely, yeah. And it often doesn't require the shaking by the lapel. Sometimes it just happens to be that one individual in the room. The subtle push is just another to be a reminder. Based on time, this gives us an opportunity now to be able to talk about what it is as far as relationships that we feel would serve the program best right now, going into Series 11. But I'm going to sort of split this a little bit. I mean, as far as what I'm saying, what serves best, we're looking at it as something that is going to satisfy established veteran viewers. But then, as we often like to talk about in the cast, we're always talking about, bear in mind, the program, this is a business. At the end of the day, you need to attract new viewers. You need to keep farming new viewers. You need people to carry on the love of the program. So you're not only trying to appeal to or present a character relationship that's going to appeal to your veteran viewers that are holding you up to some very high standards, possibly some unreachable standards, but you're also trying to constantly attract new viewers. So what could be the kinds of dynamics and character interplay and relationships that we think the audience is currently thirsty for?
I mean, just based, if you look at the cast photo for what the new series is going to be, you see, it seems very much like, you know, William Hartnell's era, where you've got, you know, you've got some adults, you've got some kids, so any viewer that comes in is going to have a character that they can latch onto and be like, oh, that's the character that's like me. That's me traveling with the Doctor and
not
see that part of themselves.
The diversity of the casting and just trying to make sure that this is in every audience.
Mm.
Okay.
And I have to say, just to sort of agree with you there, I am looking forward to a little bit more crowded TARDIS, personally. I like a TARDIS that has at least two companions in it. And, you know, I have nothing against many of the companions that have traveled solo with the Doctor. I mean, like Donna, for example, I think is fantastic. I really enjoyed Clara by the end. But I really like what happens to the stories when you have at least one more person than that traveling in the TARDIS. So mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay. And I think you've had the opportunity to be able to toy around with some of the different pairings, triplings, different numerical counts as far. Do you find that it's more comfortable when you're working with something like that's like the stage triangle? You know, and then that's sort of a...
I think it's not a question of personality. It's a question of knowledge. And what I'd like to see is the companion to know things the Doctor doesn't. I think the Doctor always places his companions at a disadvantage because he knows so much. And I would like to see a little bit... You can get more drama, say with Perry and the Piscon Paradox. Perry knows so much the Doctor doesn't know. Mm-hmm. And again, in Kingmaker, the Doctor is completely in the dark. I mean, I would like to see... I don't know. I'd like to see... the new series has done a lot of things that... particularly with Stephen doing the time travel thing that the classic series didn't really tackle a lot. Mm. And I'd like to see the Turlough sleeper agent revisited in a better and more kind of coherent form. Mm. And I would like... You know, I'd like to see some scenes without the Doctor in that the audience knows that the Doctor doesn't know. Because I think that's more interesting... because that used to be a staple, and I think that's kind of gone away because we're all focused on the Doctor and everything has to have the Doctor and the Doctor has to know what's going on. And I'd like to see a little bit more dynamic of things that we know as an audience but the Doctor doesn't know.
It's funny, and even within Moffat's writing itself, it may be interesting to note that he has actually experimented more with putting the genius at a disadvantage in the Sherlock series of late than he has with the Doctor. You know, there were some of the most compelling episodes within the latter couple series of Sherlock when he's off the rails and is spiraling and it's become the support team in there to try to set everything straight. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the novelty of the fact is we've gotten away from that.
Yes.
And so maybe the time is right to sort of reintroduce that kind of a flip to
how it. I mean, I said the imperfect Doctor is great and it actually is a great leveler. I do find writing for the Six and Perry now very enjoyable, because the Six Doctor is such an imperfect character, and Perry is an intelligent woman, and that just brings things together a bit more. And certainly the John Nathan Turner Doctors, the Fifth and the Sixth, they are very imperfect characters, and they seem to be more of a level with their companions, and it feels like there's a better dynamic going on. Not necessarily as well realised as it should be in the series at the time, but it just feels like there is more scope for a companion to know things that the Doctor doesn't, and to have things that the Doctor doesn't, without crowding the Doctor out. You can't make companions more interesting than the Doctor. That's impossible. That is commercial suicide. Mm. But you can give them things that the Doctor doesn't have, one doesn't know.
So I guess when we last time we held a variation of this panel was when we were leading into the Bill Potts era, and we didn't really know what to expect from Bill. And it was actually the consensus among the conversation we were having around the room that we were waiting for something that was going to return to the Seventh and Ace kind of professor-pupil relationship. We wanted to see something where there were opportunities to be able to knock the corners off of the 12th Doctor's spikiness, just like that. And to a certain degree, they were going to reintroduce some humor elements that we felt might have been missing a little bit coming out of Series 10, where things were getting, even though they were having a specific focus on bringing things, well, admittedly, more dramatic. They were going to hold things a bit longer. They were going to let things simmer for longer for dramatic emphasis. But it got to a seriousness point where we need a break. Oh, as a viewer, we needed a bit of a pressure release because it was getting a little intense. And I think, to a certain degree, with a particular amount of balance, I think they succeeded in doing so in Series 11 because we did have such an affable relationship between the two, and they were able to kind of, you know, nudge at each other. And Nardal, much to my own surprise, actually served well to be and I kept referring to this, and I'm going to hold to this. Nardal was the classic Whovian's companion in Series 11, whereas Bill was the new Whovian companion. So you had a companion for both viewing eras alongside a Doctor who loved the breadth and scope of it. I mean, Capaldi, being, you know, the man that he is, said, "I want to be the Doctor for both sides of this because I am both sides of this." And Stephen said, "I want to give you a companion that pulls you in both directions." So, is there something coming into Series 11 that we think, you know what? I think right now we would be well served, especially since we don't. This is the kicker. We don't officially know that the three individuals who have been described as recurring characters with the Doctor are canon companions. You can get into semantics about what that really means.
I can't wait for the 5 years of panel discussions we have where we argue about whether or not they count as companions.
Exactly. So, but is there something, even putting all that aside, is there something where we need to see, like, I want to see, you know, something that has the Doctor stepping back and saying, you know what, I'm really out of my element at the moment, and I need a little bit of guidance because I can't communicate with any of you right now because there's a syntactical error of some sort, and I need to be brought into this. So coach me to help me through this so that I can put my intellect in your vocabulary, or instances like that. I mean, is this the kind of thing that we might be engaged with, or is it a matter of, without necessarily going with a flawed Doctor, or maybe going with a Doctor with flaws, without going the superhero film right now of the broken hero? I'm getting tired a little bit of the broken.
Well,
like, literally.
We just kind of had the Doctor who can't care, so I don't think we need to do that again.
Right.
You know, we had care. You know, Clara was his carer. She cares, so he doesn't have to. I, you know, if we do that exact same thing again, like we just did that, we don't need to do that again.
So. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what the regeneration crisis, quote-unquote, is with this Doctor, because I think that often kind of shapes the rest of the series arc. But this is kind of going back to like what Haley and Heather were saying before. I think that what's great about having a crowded TARDIS is that you can have all different dynamics between the Doctor and Companion, and then amongst the Companions if they are all traveling with her full-time. And I like having that student-teacher relationship in the TARDIS to some degree, because the student can always be a teacher to some extent, and I there is something about that kind of relationship that feels kind of like in the core DNA of the show. So I would hope that that's preserved in one of the relationships that we see. I don't know.
I agree. I emphatically agree. Well, they're going to be calling us for time. This is obviously a conversation that can go on for, well, until...
54 years?
Well, or at least until the autumn when we start getting proven wrong. So we'll see what emerges.
It's autumn until December 21st.
It is, that is very true. So go, don't make me wait until December 21st. Are you kidding me? All right. But thank you so much, my panel, Heather, Haley, Nev, Joy, for the conversation. And we will see everyone on the floor. So there you have it. A lot of things rehashed of what we've actually discussed here on the cast in years prior, both just in general conversation while the series is running, anytime we're being introduced to a new companion, but specifically at some of these pivotal points, like when we were headed into the Capaldi era and wondering how things were going to go with a new doctor against an existing companion, and then the introduction of Bill, and wanting to know how an existing doctor would do with a new companion. Now we've got another clean slate situation like we had going into the 11th hour with Matt Smith, so maybe shades of the same.
I mean, it just goes to show that this is one of the reasons why we always have such an easy time imagining ourselves running off with the doctors, because the companion is designed to be us. So, yeah, it's one of those things that, of course we can picture that, because that's what we're intended to do.
Right. Yeah, I think if they were ever to take a real leap and go with something very alien, which they haven't done in quite a long time, it would have to be, I think, honestly, a situation where you'd have to at least add to an existing TARDIS team.
Exactly.
So that you continue to have your human touch point.
Mm-hmm.
But this actually kind of brings us, interestingly, into one of the items we have for our news tonight. So I'm going to rearrange the order on how we were going to discuss this, because it just kind of poked me in the brain here. There's been some changes, as often do happen over at the individuals who make up the editing and writing teams and content teams behind Doctor Who magazine. Back in 1999 or so, they decided that they were going to assemble this time team, that were going to be individuals who were going to do a chronological watch through the classic stories.
What kind of idiots would take that task on?
I don't know. It took them 10 years. just to give you a little scope of reference there. And they had to even, there was even a hiatus involved in it. So what we've learned is that they're going to be taking another pass at the time team concept, but they're going to do so exponentially larger.
Yeah.
We're looking at what, close to...
I think it's a dozen people this time.
Dozen people. Average age of 22. Okay, so these are all intrinsically New Whovians. In fact, a large number of them were not even... they were like age 7 or so in 2005 when the show returned. So this is... I think the only thing about this, and I know this has been causing a fascinating stir online, as it seems to be all of those the salty grump bags who didn't have enough time complaining about Jodie Whittaker and the casting of the 13th Doctor are now completely up in arms about the fact that their precious Doctor Who magazine is going through an evolution that is leaving them behind, as they see it. And these couldn't possibly be fans of the program, because they haven't even been on this planet long enough to truly appreciate that they do. I will point at a couple of things in particular here. Number one, one of the familiar faces that you will see continued through this time team is Crystal D. Crystal D, obviously, the most prominent face behind the Doctor Who fan show, and is all over YouTube, and you've seen her pretty much everywhere under the sun that has been with the program to date. She is an immense talent and is probably one of the most devoted fans of the program, past, present, that you're ever going to meet. So anyone that wants to say that Crystal is not a fan of the program can, frankly, suck it. Number two, the fact that we've that they are being upset over a new generation of fans who are becoming absolutely fascinated with the program and want to actively go back and learn more about it. If that bothers you, you need to go rethink your fandom.
But they're not liking it the way that I like it.
Of course not, yeah. I actually saw arguments, complaints filed specifically to Benjamin Cook that were saying things like, if you haven't seen the program in grainy, line-drawn black and white, then you can't fully appreciate the wonder that was the sci-fi advances of the program in the late 60s, early 70s.
Right, because they haven't made any kind of advances at all since then.
No, absolutely not. You have to so you have to take it upon yourself to go find a cathode ray tube, 9-inch black and white screen, drop it down a couple of flights of stairs so that the vertical hole just goes absolutely bonkers.
Convince your kid brother to stand in the corner with the antenna.
And then try and watch Marco Polo. Try and watch it. You can't, because it's not. But yeah, it's just, I'm thrilled that they're doing this. There are even some people that are saying, it's time to retire this segment because it obviously doesn't serve any purpose anymore. It absolutely serves a purpose because this is showing the fact that, as I said, new fans wanting to get a fuller appreciation of the legacy of them.
I'm excited for this. Yeah. I can't.
I only had one little sticking point, and that happened to be with the fact that they're not going to be doing it chronologically, though.
Yeah, they're going to take it more as themes. So, like, they're going to do Rose, Spearhead from Space, and Time of the Ronnie. So it's the first appearances of 9, 3, and 7.
Okay.
So, like, we've done that ourselves, where we just kind of like, here, let's cherry pick a couple episodes to fit what we're looking. But yeah, I don't know. I would be interested to see how they go through it. But at the same time, this has got to evolve just as the same as the audience does.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in a lot of cases, somebody who's just themselves trying to take this on, they don't have necessarily the opportunity or the avenue to be able to go and grab the stories chronologically. Right. They may only have the opportunity to go, all right, I'm going to jump over to BritBox and see what's available for streaming. Or I'm going to go to my local library and see what DVD sets or Blu-ray sets that they have on record. Hopefully. You know, if it means that I have to jump into the Fifth Doctor, then I jump into the Fifth Doctor and I'm just going to do my best. And I totally understand that. If they're trying to do some kind of a thematic assessment of this, they're putting themselves at a little bit of a disadvantage if some of these people haven't seen any Classic Who content, because they're really, I mean, we've seen it with Haley. I mean, we use her as our guinea pig on this. When we do our cherry picking and we do a little hopping around for the sake of particular episode conversations, and she's getting things anachronistically, then when we went back and started doing the classic rewatch in order, I think even she admitted that she was picking up things that she might have been at a disadvantage had she not been able to see stories previous. So, yeah. Something to be gained, I guess. But again, it has to be, it's opportunistic. So, I wish them the absolute best, a great time with it. I think it's going to make for some really interesting reading as well, with what they come up with, their observations, yeah, especially with a group this large. So, but, I don't know. Speaking of the classics, about as classic as you can get, apparently some of you didn't dig deeply enough into your wallets, because if you did, you would have owned the script from the first episode of Mythly Child.
And not just any version of the script. This is actually William Hartnell's script.
I love the fact that whenever they have these kind of stories, they're like, nah, we found it in a box in the back of a barn under a cake. It was in his cottage by a developer who just happened to be going through and said, oh, you like that Doctor Who program, and gave it to his grandson. Right. So time progresses. They decide that they're going to put it up for auction, and it pulls down 6,200 pounds. So I wouldn't have been surprised if it could have gone for something more.
Yeah, I did feel like that was kind of a low number, but I mean, that we're talking, what, like 11,000-12,000 American?
Yeah, about that.
So, I mean, that's a pretty substantial sum, so.
It is, yeah, yeah. But I'm just glad to see that there is sufficient interest that that fans are still jumping out there to grab these kinds of pieces of memorabilia and history. We had this case. We had the fact that there are currently this is slightly tangential, but it's still interesting nonetheless. There are a handful, and by handful I mean, all right, let's call this closer to a dozen, or maybe even as many as 15 or so, different items that Haley Nibauer, our costume designer from our previous series, and some of the other principal designers of late have put up on eBay UK for auction that'll be going to charity. So you can do things like you can own, what were some of the things that are still active? One of Bill's jackets. I just saw there was Nardal's orange coat, the big woolly coat with the funny looking buttons on it there. You can grab a hold of that when you wanted to. A couple of the hats. A lot of remnants that you could pick up for just a couple of pounds. You just want a little piece of Missy's coat. You just want a little snippet of the Victorian outfit that Bill wore in Thin Ice. That stuff is all there, and you can own your own little piece of it right now. The auctions are down to a handful of pounds. I mean, you just get them for a couple of quid, and or at least get yourself in on the bids and see where it goes. And no matter where it goes, your donations are going to go towards something very worthwhile. So yeah, the interest all around, from the classics to the new. And it just warms my heart.
Definitely. But the last bit of news here, and I mean, come on, it wouldn't be GPR if we didn't start glowing about a new Big Finish release.
Yes, I'm going to glow, but I'm going to glow quizzically. we're in January of next year, we will be seeing another...